This is a special edition of the CBS News Weekend Roundup, Boston Bombings. I'm Dan Revive. The two bomb explosions that killed three people and wounded more than 170 near the finish line of the Boston Marathon on Monday led to a marathon of a manhunt on Friday. And after nightfall, at about 8:45 p.m. Eastern Time, the one man being hunted was captured. President Obama rapidly commented.
Obviously, tonight there are still many unanswered questions. Among them, why did young men who grew up and studied here as part of our communities and our country resort to such violence? How did they plan and carry out these attacks? And did they receive any help? The families of those killed so senselessly deserve answers. The wounded, some of whom now have to learn how to stand and walk and live again, deserve answers. And so I've instructed the FBI and the Department of Homeland Security and our intelligence community to continue to deploy all the necessary resources to support the investigation, to collect intelligence, and to protect our citizens.
After nightfall, at about 8:45 p.m. Eastern Time, the one man being hunted was captured. People who live in Watertown, Massachusetts, a nearby suburb of Boston, were so elated they went outside and applauded the police as they left the scene. The man had been hiding in a boat that was stored for the winter in the backyard of a house in Watertown. How did that happen? Well, the governor of Massachusetts, Deval Patrick, had just told the public, okay, we know you cannot stay indoors forever. Go out, live your lives, but please be careful. That meant that the so-called lockdown was over. CBS News senior correspondent John Miller reported.
The lockdown was all day, and as it's lifted, one of these people, the gentleman who owns that house on Franklin, for the first time, because he's been locked in all day, decides he's going to go outside and check on things. He walks to the back of the house and he sees what appears to be a tear in the tarp covering his boat. So he gets a ladder and climbs up to see what the rip is about, and he says, I lift it up, and inside I see a bloody mess. He goes back into the house, he dials 911. The first three people there are three Boston police officers. What we're told is that a shot came from the boat. There were shots exchanged. And then the incident commander said to work ceasefire and set up a perimeter. So they set up a very tight perimeter around this location. And then at that point, the FBI's elite hostage rescue team responded to the scene and took over tactical command of that scene. And once they had the bomb techs clear the pathway to make sure there were no devices or booby traps, the HRT operators approached the boat, got a look inside, came inside, pulled this suspect out.
And Boston police sent out on their Twitter stream the following rhyming tweet, captured. The hunt is over, the search is done, the terror is over, and justice has won. Let's go back to how Friday began in that suburb, Watertown. Very early in the morning, around 1 a.m. Friday, there had been a gun battle between police and two men identified now as brothers, the suspects in the Boston Marathon bombing, Tamerlan Tsarnaev, age 26, and his younger brother, Johar, 19. Events became violent Thursday night. CBS News correspondent Don Daler in Watertown on Friday.
Police flooded the area just across the Charles River from Boston shortly after 10:20, after a report that a policeman had been shot.
Push that ALS unit off the down. They're working it. They're trying to get him there.
Police believe the Tsarnaev brothers shot Massachusetts Institute of Technology police officer Sean Collier.
Okay, what's this area cutting off? It's the crime scene.
At 11:30, the Tsarnaevs allegedly carjacked a man just a few blocks away. They released him a half hour later at a gas station. The brothers were spotted in the stolen car in Watertown 90 minutes later.
He is responding. Pursuit on School Street.
A running gun battle began. Police reported explosives being thrown from the vehicle.
Here they have explosives, some type of grenades. They're in between the houses down here.
Watertown resident Adonis Karagiorgios heard the chaos.
So when I came out on the balcony to see what was going on, I heard a tremendous explosion that just lit up the night sky.
The battle recorded by terrified residents. Police say Tamerlan Tsarnaev approached them carrying a bomb, but it malfunctioned.
Loud explosion! Loud explosion! Loud explosion!
Transit officer Richard Donahue was shot. So was Tamerlan. He died of his wounds. But his brother slipped away.
On Friday's CBS Evening News, Scott Pelley spoke with law enforcement correspondent Bob Orr.
I wonder what law enforcement officers are telling you about the way these men have conducted their attack on Monday and conducted themselves since then.
Well, they were pretty good at the start, Scott. The bombs were not very sophisticated, but the plot was expertly conceived and executed. They managed to buy the bomb-making materials, they built the devices, and they managed to sneak away from the bombing scene, all undetected. Veteran investigators we've been talking to who have watched the surveillance tapes were struck by the men's cool precision in planting the bombs and then in making the escapes. They only displayed one sign of carelessness. They acted in full view of multiple surveillance cameras.
CBS News correspondent Bob Orr, after the mother of the two suspects claimed that the elder son, the one killed by police, had been tracked by the FBI in recent years, and she insisted these bombing charges were a total setup. The FBI did admit that special agents interviewed Tamerlan Tsarnaev 2 years ago at the request of a foreign government, understood to be Russia, concerned about his possible connections with Islamic extremists in Chechnya, part of Russia. FBI sources say no derogatory or dangerous information was found, so they closed his file. Expect questions from members of Congress and perhaps others as to whether investigators made a serious mistake not noticing a violent radical. CBS News correspondent Jim Axelrod is in Boston with more.
Johar's education was partially funded by a $2,500 scholarship given by the city of Cambridge. Larry Aronson, a teacher who knew him at Ringe and Latin High School in Cambridge, was stunned when he saw the video released by the police.
I said, that looks like there are people who have said to me, why didn't you call people and say you can identify this person? Because this is no way this could be this kid. Not Dahar, not him.
So, because why?
Because there's nothing about him that would suggest anything like this. Politics, religion, nothing.
His brother's alleged involvement may not be as surprising. In 2009, Tamerlan was arrested for assaulting his girlfriend. But by 2010, in a Boston University magazine, he was describing himself as very religious. He said, I don't have a single American friend because I don't understand them. Mechanic Gilberto Jr. fixed cars for the brothers. He last saw Johar Tsarnaev on Tuesday, the day after the bombing. Johar insisted he needed his car back right away, a week ahead of schedule.
I hope they'll catch him alive.
Why do you hope they'll catch him alive?
You know, he has to suffer.
Car mechanic Gilbert Jr., who knew the two bombing suspects. You're listening to a special edition of the CBS News Weekend Roundup, Boston Bombings. I'm Dan Revive. You're listening to a special edition of the CBS News Weekend Roundup, Boston Bombings. I'm Dan Revive. The two alleged bombers, the brothers believed to have built the bombs and planted them near the finish line of the marathon this past Monday. Who were they? Tamerlan and Johar Tsarnaev, ages 26 and 19. They lived in the United States for about 11 years. Their aunt, Maret Tsarnaev, lives in Canada.
It is totally shock to me to hear that this is on our family. This is total shock.
But in Toronto, she told reporters she does not believe it, saying the FBI probably staged the photos and video of the two brothers walking near the bomb site. She says her nephews were good boys. She did say the elder brother, Tamerlan, became a very religious Muslim 2 years ago. She adds that his wife is from a good Christian family.
They cannot go crazy or mad or sick or psychic just for one day. As far as I know them, they were fine, in good health, in good mind. What happened?
The president of Chechnya issued a statement also expressing skepticism about the U.S. charges, adding that if they are true, then don't blame Chechen culture, blame America. Here's what Pat Milton of the CBS News investigative unit was able to find out, something fascinating about the younger brother, Johar, who was the target of Friday's manhunt.
Yes, ironically, our law enforcement sources tell us that the younger brother became a U.S. citizen on September 11th, 2012. The source said that he came to the United States on a tourist visa in April of 2002, sought asylum in September of 2002, and then gained lawful residency status in September 07.
Right. How ironic that date, 9/11, just about 7 months ago. Now, let's look at this, Pat Milton. You say that he arrived on a tourist visa. You may know we've discovered that he and three siblings arrived, with the elder brother who's now dead, and apparently with two sisters, and we believe their parents arrived as a family 11 years ago, April of 2002. That means that Jokar, the one they're looking for right now, he was 8 years old. I got it. He sought asylum a couple of months later. But he was 8 years old. That means his parents sought asylum. What's your instinct? Would anybody think this is a terror cell being planted in the United States?
You know, it's just unclear what was going on. You know, we're hearing reports from people that knew Jokar, went to school with him, and they reported him as a no-problem a child, a no-problem youngster in growing up. So it's unclear when he took a turn.
Pat Milton with the CBS News Investigative Unit, thanks so much. Beth Noble also knows a lot about the family now. For many years as our bureau manager at CBS News in Moscow, a Russian speaker. You got the father of the Tsarnaevs on the telephone. Beth, what did he say about his sons, the FBI saying they were the Boston Marathon bombers?
The father says that they immigrated more than 10 years ago, and he told me that the boys feel like Americans, which makes sense if they came to the U.S., you know, at a fairly young age. He literally said they wouldn't hurt a fly, but he's clearly in shock, and he's clearly just furious about the fact that his older son was killed and not taken prisoner.
That man's brother, Ruslan Tsarny, is a Chechen immigrant living near Washington, D.C.
The only purpose here is just to deliver our condolences and to share grief with the real victims here. Those who've been murdered, those who've been injured. I've been following it from day one, but never ever would imagine that somehow a children of my brother would be associated with that. So it is atrocity.
When was the last time you saw them?
I don't know. We've not been in touch with that family for a number of years. They never lived here.
When's the last time you saw them?
The last time I saw them was December 2005.
Did you ever know them to have any ill will towards the United States?
No, no.
What do you think provoked this?
Being losers, hatred to those who were able to settle themselves. These are the only reasons. Anything else to do with religion, with Islam, it's a fraud, it's a fake. Of course, we're ashamed. Yes, we're ashamed. They're children of my brother. No, they've never been in Chechnya. It has nothing to do with Chechnya. Chechens are different. Chechens are peaceful people. So they put that shame on the entire ethnicity. Turn yourself in.
Now an inspirational speech, President Obama's message in the Cathedral of the Holy Cross in Boston during an interfaith service when almost 2,000 people gathered in tribute to the victims of the bombings at the marathon.
If they sought to intimidate us, to terrorize us, to shake us from those values that make us who we are as Americans, well, it should be pretty clear by now that they picked the wrong city to do it. Not here in Boston. Not here in Boston. You've shown us, Boston, that in the face of evil, Americans will lift up what's good. In the face of cruelty, we will choose compassion. In the face of those who would visit death upon innocence, we will choose to save and to comfort and to heal. We'll choose friendship. We'll choose love. For Scripture teaches us God has not given us a spirit of fear and timidity, but of power, love, and self-discipline. And that's the spirit you've displayed in recent days. When doctors and nurses, police and firefighters and EMTs and guardsmen run towards explosions to treat the wounded, that's discipline. when exhausted runners, including our troops and veterans who never expected to see such carnage on the streets back home, become first responders themselves, tending to the injured. That's real power.
President Obama at an interfaith service in Boston on Thursday. What you're hearing now is an unusual sign of solidarity, if not affection, for Boston in Yankee Stadium in New York City. The logo of the usually hated Boston Red Sox was on big screens next to the Yankees logo. And at the game, the music after the third inning was the unofficial anthem of Red Sox fans. It's always played at their Fenway Park. Neil Diamond's Sweet Caroline. Diamond said on Twitter that he totally approved. You're listening to a special edition of the CBS News Weekend Roundup, Boston Bombings. I'm Dan Ravine. You're listening to a special edition of the CBS News Weekend Roundup, Boston Bombings. I'm Dan Ravine.
What's so proud?
Those were hockey fans, around 20,000 people in Boston Garden at the Bruins game on Tuesday. Everyone knew what was going on. That was defiance. They were singing our national anthem the day after someone tried to scar their city by killing people at the Boston Marathon on Monday. Those killed were a local boy, 8 years old, Martin Richard, a suburban restaurant manager, Crystal Campbell, she was 29, and a graduate student from China, Lu Lingzi, age 23. When law enforcement authorities on Friday named the alleged perpetrators, Tamerlan Tsarnaev, who was killed in a shootout with police, and his younger brother, Johar, reporters naturally rushed to find out everything possible about them. They lived in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and Beth Germano of Boston CBS station WBZ-TV discovered that the younger brother was enrolled in college at the University of Massachusetts campus in Dartmouth, 70 miles south of Boston and Cambridge. Beth spoke with CBS's Bill Whitney about that.
Beth, one of the brothers attended classes there, correct?
And that's what prompted an evacuation of the campus, Bill. At first, they just closed down school when they realized that 19-year-old Johar Tsarnaev was, in fact, a sophomore here. About a half an hour after that, they ordered a complete evacuation, and as we arrived, all students were trying to leave the campus with their belongings, waiting for rides. And when we got inside, we saw a very large presence around a Pinedale dormitory. That's a sophomore residence hall where Johar apparently lives. But obviously, they're looking for any kind of evidence that could be linked to Monday. We did speak with several students who know him, a couple of soccer teammates of his. He plays on a soccer league here. He was at practice a couple of weeks ago. They saw him. Nothing seemed amiss. Of course, he was not at practice. On Monday, they say, they tried to call him and got no response. I did speak with not one, but a couple of different students who say they saw him on campus this week after the bombings. In fact, one student said to me he lives in the same Cambridge area as Johar, and he asked him if he could get a ride home this weekend, and he says the student agreed. He never really discussed politics or any kind of political agenda. They just describe him as a very quiet student, kind of studious. It's sort of unclear his major. I've heard engineering, I've heard medicine, I've heard economics. But they say he's quiet, and in a very large campus here, he sort of blended in. And so when they all woke up and saw the picture, they recognized him right away, but they couldn't believe that was one of their classmates, Bill.
That's what struck me when the pictures were first released, is that they looked so normal. They looked like average American young men.
Well, that's just it exactly. And one student that we spoke with said the hat. He recognized the baseball hat. And that's what they all say. They're just these. He's a classmate. He's a doormate. They see him in the hallways. They see him in classes. And they can't believe that this potential bombing suspect was living among them and was on campus this week. As one student said, I am shocked that he would come back and try to mingle with us after what went on. If, in fact, he was on campus, as students say he was.
Beth Germano with CBS's WBZ-TV. Now, keep in mind that even when chasing alleged bombers, law enforcement always had to think about the eventual prosecution. At least that's what's on their minds when they do their work. First, they want to prevent violence, and they do want to lock up whoever is responsible for crime. Of course, one of the suspects was killed in a firefight And then all day there was the search for the other man, for his younger brother. We turn to CBS News senior legal analyst Andrew Cohen. Take us through some of the legal aspects of this, starting with that, that when there is a firefight, when apparently two men are driving across the greater Boston area, and they may be even dropping explosives, you know, out of the window of a stolen car, the police aren't thinking about legal niceties at that point.
When the police talk about a wide crime scene, they're not just talking about the physical area where a crime occurred. They're talking about an area from which they want to get evidence that they can later use at trial if there's going to be a prosecution, if there's going to be a legal case of murder and terrorism and bombing and conspiracy and all the other charges on a federal level that would apply. So they have to be conscious. They're trained to be conscious. Even as they're pursuing and even as they're securing a crime scene, they have to be conscious of the evidence. And that's why so much of what has gone on so slowly. You're worried about public safety. You're worried about a bomb going off. You're worried about preventing other people, innocent victims, from being killed. But you're also worried that if you do apprehend the suspect, you're going to have a viable case, and you're only going to have a viable case based upon the evidence that you seize at these scenes.
So when a big section of downtown Boston was closed off to the public, Copley Square, and even more, late Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday into Thursday. Indeed, members of the public were impatient, but basically the police were trying to investigate to catch the criminals, but also get the evidence that prosecutors would need.
Sure, absolutely. That's why you secure a crime scene. And you know, the analogy that I keep going back to is the Oklahoma City bombing. The Alfred Murrah building was blown up 18 years ago. And as soon as the dust had settled, investigators were in there trying to get information, trying to get evidence. And some of the evidence they got in those early days linked them to Timothy McVeigh. A similar situation has happened here. The evidence from the crime scene, the backpack and so forth, that information led the police to the suspects that they sought.
They find a shredded backpack on the scene, and by reviewing all of the photos and all the video, they think they spot a young man and then two with similar backpacks.
Sure, exactly. And what you're seeing there, Dan, is the physical evidence captured from the scene that links the police to an identification, a personal eyewitness identification, this time from the cameras. And that leads the police to the suspects, and then you have a case that's perhaps solved. And so, you know, the underlying layer to all of this has been, even as this manhunt has gone on, the layer has been, look, if we're going to capture this person alive, then we have to have a case at the end of the day. And the case that you have at the end of the day is based upon all this information and evidence.
And I suppose, Andrew, there is the sad fact that here we are, an open democracy. We're going to have happy events like the Boston Marathon on that unique Massachusetts holiday, Patriots Day, once a year. And the enemies of democracy find it easy to attack us in places and times like that.
Well, I think that's right. And I think the lesson of this is going to be even more security at this soft events, these sorts of soft events. There's only so much you can do. There are already the backpack searches going into auditoriums and sports stadiums and so forth. We're going to see more of that. And we're going to see more civil liberties challenges, even as the law enforcement ramps itself up. You know, you always learn from the last war. And, well, you know, the bombing of the Boston Marathon is the last war. And it'll be interesting to see how that changes the dynamic going forward. We had not really even settled from the terror attacks of 9/11, and now we have this. And I know this is something that law enforcement officials and counterterrorism officials had been worrying about for, you know, beyond 9/11. They have to obviously worry about it even more today.
CBS News senior legal analyst Andrew Cohen. Thank you, Andrew.
My pleasure, Dan.
You're listening to a special edition of the CBS News Weekend Roundup, Boston Bombings. I'm Dan Ravine. You're listening to a special edition of the CBS News Weekend Roundup, Boston Bombings. I'm Dan Ravine. There's been a lot of discussion here in the United States recently of guns. This past week, gun control measures proposed in the U.S. Senate failed to get enough votes to move forward. That after massacres last year in a movie theater in Colorado and an elementary school in Connecticut. But in this attempt at mass murder in Massachusetts, near the finish line of the Boston Marathon, the weapons were two homemade bombs, at least one built in an ordinary kitchen item, a pressure cooker. CBS's Bob Orr reported on that on Tuesday, the day after the crime.
Law enforcement officials say the bombs contained an explosive similar to black powder. They were laced with BBs, ball bearings, and nails. Trauma surgeon George Velmahas says many of the injured have multiple shrapnel wounds.
They are numerous. They're people who have 10, 20, 30, 40 of them in their body or more.
Investigators believe the bombs were hidden in black nylon backpacks and housed inside sealable metal pots called pressure cookers. Pressure cooker bombs can help boost the power of relatively small devices by briefly constraining the blast. And when the cookers do explode, they can add large chunks of metal to the shrapnel spray. The IEDs have been popular with terrorists. Al-Qaeda published a how-to recipe in an online jihadi magazine. 7 of the bombs were used in a 2006 attack on trains in Mumbai, India. In 2004 and 2010, the Department of Homeland Security warned law enforcement that pressure cooker bombs could present a threat in the U.S. In the failed Times Square attack in May 2010, a pressure cooker was found amid the bomb components in the back of the suspect's SUV.
That from CBS's Bob Orr. Also on Tuesday, with a large part of downtown Boston closed to vehicles and pedestrians, CBS's John Miller explained that that was all about collecting evidence. A mountain of clues so high, it was hard to find a golden needle in a haystack of worthless debris and information.
Logan Airport, as people were departing on international and domestic flights, the Customs and Border Patrol, the agents from Immigration and Customs Enforcement were greeting them on their way out and saying, before you get 3,000 miles away, do you have an iPhone? Do you have a camera? Did you take pictures at the marathon? Can we download that right now? Can we get that digital media from you? So they are going to be buried under a mountain of this stuff, and what they're going to do is triage it. They're going to look at when it was taken in terms of how close to the explosion in terms of timing and where it was taken, how close to the two places where the bombs were placed, and they're going to go through those first, and then they will widen out in concentric circles and try to look at every piece they get. They're prepared for a mountain of information. They've activated a system called Orion, which is a computer database that'll catalog every one of those leads and be searchable, and they're going to deploy DIVS, the Digital Investigation Visualization System, which will help link leads and link them to any information in other FBI cases. This is something they've been through before, and they've gotten better at it.
CBS's John Miller on Tuesday. On Friday, after the suspects, the brothers who lived in Cambridge, Massachusetts, were identified as immigrants whose family roots were in Chechnya, I spoke with CBS News foreign correspondent Clarissa Ward and national security analyst Juan Zarate.
This is what's really confusing here. I mean, Chechnya has a long history of terrorist involvement, but primarily these terrorist attacks that Chechens have engaged in have targeted Russia. The Chechen terrorists see themselves as separatists. They want independence for Chechnya. There's been no indication that previously that the U.S. would be a target for Chechens. At the same time, we do see radical Islamist groups inside of Chechnya. They are part of this Salafist jihadist circuit. We've seen Chechens fighting in Syria, for example, with the rebels there. So it's a little confusing at this stage as to why these young men would target the U.S. when traditionally Chechens see their greatest enemy as being Russia.
Let's bring Juan Zarate into that a total surprise that Chechenian radicals would target the U.S., Juan?
Not a total surprise. I think the notion, though, that the Chechen separatists and those from Dagestan and Ingushetia, which are neighboring regions, have focused on Russia is absolutely right. Keep in mind that the Russians have undergone a long-term fight with terrorists. These terrorists have, remember, attacked the Moscow theater, Beslan, the subways in Moscow, suicide bombers on airliners. And so the Russians have endured quite a bit. But what's interesting over the last 10 years is you've started to see an admixture of the types of groups and individuals that are operating. And so, for example, in 2007, you had Germans plotting against American bases in Germany as part of a Central Asian group. So it's not altogether unusual to start to see the blending of these groups and individuals. And this is a global Salafi jihadi movement, and Chechnya has always been a cause celeb, and so you never quite know what's going to motivate actors.
What do you want to find out, and how quickly do we need to know?
I think government officials and counterterrorism officials right now will be looking intensely at the international connections of these individuals. As of late yesterday, there were no indications of an international dimension to the attack on the Boston Marathon, and so with these identifications, with more information about where these individuals were from and when they got to the United States, there's going to be an intensity to try to determine what their connections and associations are. That's important for a couple reasons, Dan. First, you've got to determine if there's something else at play here. Are there other associates, other conspirators who might be part of a plan? Secondly, you've got to understand if they, you know, where they were trained from, or were they trained? You raise a very good point, Dan. This may not be the traditional terrorist sleeper cell that we've been accustomed to thinking about. They may not have been launched by a known Chechen or Ingushet or Dagestani terrorist organization. They may simply be from the region, sensitive to the issues of oppression and sensitive to the themes of terrorist groups, and may be radicalized while here and simply determined on their own in homegrown fashion to take actions on their own, which in some ways is exactly what Al-Qaeda over the last few years has been preaching, to attack in place where you can.
Without necessarily training overseas. Does this case remind you of the Times Square would-be bomber? Right, his bomb fizzled even as he parked a car by Times Square in New York. He had gotten some training or guidance, I believe, in Pakistan.
Very good point, Dan. Keep in mind that Faisal Shahzad, the Times Square failed bomber, did get some training. It was minimal training from the Pakistan Taliban, the TTP as it's known, was sent abroad to attack. Fortunately, he failed in that attack, but keep in mind as well that he had been living in the U.S. for some time, and he was not on the radar screen of counterterrorism officials until he attempted the attack. And so we've got to keep that in mind as we think through what was on the intelligence screen before the attack, and as we analyze what happens now as we get more information.
CBS News analyst Juan Zarate. You're listening to a special edition of the CBS News Weekend Roundup, Boston Bombings. I'm Dan Ravine. You're listening to a special edition of the CBS News Weekend Roundup, Boston Bombings. I'm Dan Ravine. Nothing could be worse than coming across a wounded child. You're about to hear a woman in Boston who, in the seconds after the two bombs exploded near the finish line of the marathon, didn't run away. She ran forward to help people. She saw Martin Richard, 8 years old. He was dead. This woman helped Martin's little sister, a 6-year-old, who lost a leg in the explosion. CBS News correspondent Elaine Quijano has the story.
Tracy Monroe had come to the marathon to cheer on her friends and family.
When you decided to turn back, what did you think you were going to be able to do?
You know, I really didn't have a plan. I had no idea what to expect.
She was swept up in the crowd running from the blasts, but stopped.
What did you see when you went back?
I went straight over to this child, and this man was working on her wounds. Her leg had been blown off. I just knelt down close to her, and I just rubbed the side of her face. I tried to hold on to her hand and just rub her face. And I said, "Hi, baby, just look up at me. Look in my eyes. You know, come on. Just, it's gonna be okay. What's your name?" And she just looked up at me and said, "Jane." For I'll never forget it.
Firefighters took the little girl to the hospital. Monroe remembers seeing a little boy who turned out to be Martin Richard. She was caught on amateur video, wandering in a daze, trying to find her family.
When is it that you realized that the little boy whose picture then was on the TV, Martin Richard, was the brother of the girl you helped?
I hadn't watched any news at all. And then my dad sent a message to us just saying that they've confirmed that the little boy who died was Jane's brother. And my heart almost stopped. Like, it just, I immediately went online to see his face, and it really was him that I saw.
What is it that you want to tell Jane's family?
I want to tell them that their little girl was very, very brave. in an absolutely horrific time.
That from CBS's Elaine Cajano in Boston. And on Tuesday, the day after this murderous attack on the crowd enjoying the Boston Marathon, Elaine interviewed one of the many in the medical crews who, without doubt, by fast and smart action, saved lives.
Is it tough to talk about this?
Dr. John Pizzuto was a volunteer in the medical tent. He was treating a National Guardsman for foot blisters at the time of the explosions.
People started to run all over, get panicky, and when he said, that's definitely a bomb, we responded.
Almost everyone in the tent rushed to the wounded.
That's what changed me. That 5 minutes I was at the finish line to see the sidewalk that was now blood red. Literally everywhere.
What did it sound like?
A lot of orders being given, not a lot of panic. I mean, the nurses, the doctors, they were like they were ready for this. They knew what to do.
The battlefield injuries of one man are unforgettable.
He came in a wheelchair with a tourniquet on his left leg, and basically his tibia bone there, his leg bone there, with nothing around it. No skin, no foot, no leg.
What goes through a doctor's mind when you witness the carnage that you witnessed?
I don't think you think about that. I think you just try to help the people. It's like police and fire and the physicians. You just try to help people who need help.
But what sticks most in his mind is this woman he treated and the last thing she asked him before she left.
What's your name? And you tell them your name and you get choked up. They want to thank you and they thank you. And it's like, oh, this is real.
That from CBS News correspondent Elaine Cajano. CBS Evening News anchor Scott Pelley was also in Boston on Tuesday, pointing out that the victims of the twin bombs were probably lucky that there are about half a dozen excellent hospitals within a few miles of where the attack occurred. Scott went to Brigham and Women's Hospital and spoke with emergency room staff.
Among those in the emergency department were trauma surgeon Joaquin Havens, Dr. Ron Walls, the chairman of emergency medicine, and trauma surgeon Dr. Zara Cooper.
There were two things going through my head. One was actual fear myself, just because I hadn't been in such a situation like this before, and I really did feel like it was a war zone in some ways. And then another feeling was reassurance, because I think that everybody really pulled together in a very remarkable way.
The patients that you treated, what did you see?
A significant amount of second and third degree burns, as well as penetrating trauma from shrapnel to the face, to the neck, and to the upper extremities. Traumatic amputations from the blast.
Then there were three patients who had obviously shrapnel that was part of the device. So small 2 to 3 millimeter ball bearing type or large BB pellet type objects, and small carpenter nails about 0.5 centimeter long.
Nails and ball bearings, BBs.
They wouldn't be out there anywhere unless they were part of the device.
Is there anything else in your experience that compares to this?
The last time I saw the hospital anywhere near this was 9/11. We were told to prepare the hospital for an influx of burn patients, and nobody came. And this time we were able to help a lot more people.
People who save lives, and did so this past Monday in Boston, speaking with CBS's Scott Pelley. And it's worth reviewing highlights of what President Obama said when he visited Boston on Thursday and spoke in the Cathedral of the Holy Cross, making clear that one of his favorite cities had been knocked down by Monday's vicious attack, but
we'll pick ourselves up. We'll keep going. We will finish the race.
And he expressed complete confidence that a great tradition, the marathon, will continue.
This time next year, on the third Monday in April, the world will return to this great American city to run harder than ever and to cheer even louder for the 118th Boston Marathon.
That was on Thursday, hours before the FBI released photos and video of the two suspects, one with a black baseball cap, the other wearing a white cap. They turned out to be brothers. Mr. Obama's message to the attackers?
We will find you. We will hold you accountable. But more than that, our fidelity to our way of life, to our free and open society, will only grow stronger.
And to the people of Boston, the president said in this moment of grief, we join you in saying, Boston, you're my home.
Boston, you're my home.
Yet there's no erasing the fact that an iconic American event enjoyed by hundreds of thousands of people was considered by terrorists to be a soft target. So they chose right there in Boston to cause death and painful injury. In an open democracy, sometimes we're open to cruel attacks. This has been a special edition of the CBS News Weekend Roundup, Boston Bombings, produced by Howard Arenstein. Anytime you want to hear us, please do an internet search for CBS Weekend Roundup. You'll find our podcasts. I'm Dan Revive.